For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, this is this letter from the great apostle Paul, one of the last letters that he wrote to his young protege Timothy, a young man in probably his early 30s who had taken on a very difficult situation at the church at Ephesus. It was an ancient, very large ancient city, and this church was, things were just a mess. There were false teachers all over the place. People were losing their faith. And so Timothy is sent in here to restore order. And what we see is that one of the things that Paul is going to call on Timothy to do is he's going to call on Timothy to find, to disciple, to raise up, to train effective Christian leaders that can be released into this situation. And that's the topic for tonight and next week. Paul says in 1 Timothy 3:1, here's a trustworthy saying. There's these little trustworthy sayings throughout the letter, in 2 Timothy and Titus. And he says, whoever aspires to be an overseer desires a noble task. Well, what does he mean by that? Well, this word overseer, episkopos, literally to oversee. Episkope, a scope is like to see. Epi means over. And it says, whoever desires to be an overseer. Now, what this is a reference to is one of only two official leadership positions mentioned in the New Testament, otherwise known as an elder. The other is called a deacon, and Paul actually gets into that later on in this chapter, verses 8 through 13. And the way the early church was set up, or the way their leadership structure was set up, is you had elders, and those elders oversaw deacons. So the elders were kind of like above deacons on the org chart. And then both the elders and the deacons had authority and responsibility for the rest of the believers in these local churches. You know, a lot of people, they come from some sort of perhaps a church tradition or a church background, and they just assume, well, everybody's got their own ways of doing things, and each is just as good as another, and each is just that church's tradition of how do they set up the leadership of these churches. Well, a lot of people are surprised to find that the Bible has quite a bit of material on how the church should be set up and led. And I'd like to look at a little bit of that tonight. You know, elders and deacons, these are the two positions, also called overseer or elder. There's another word for elder. Some argue for a bishop, and they argue that this word episkopos should be bishop. And if you have a King James version, it might say if anyone wants to be a bishop, that's a good thing they desire to do. You can kind of see it's kind of the middle of this word kind of sounds like bishop, episkopos. But that's where that's descended from. And so what they would do is they would say there are elders, perhaps elders in charge of a local church for leadership, but then there's like a bishop, a single person that's in charge of those. And some denominations or some churches even have a huge hierarchy that eventually boils down to one single individual at the top of the church across the entire world. And it's based on this notion of here, a bishop and elders. Yeah, might have bishops, might have archbishops. Well, there's a problem when you look at the biblical text, because bishop and elder are used interchangeably. They're the same thing. Acts chapter 20, it says Paul sent to Ephesus, the city Timothy's at, and he called the elders of the church to come to him. But then as he's talking to this group of elders, he says, be on guard for yourselves and for all the flock among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. So which are they? Are they elders or are they so-called bishops? Well, it's the same thing. They're elders. You know, this would have been, you know, the notion of an elder. We read our Old Testaments, and the elders would sit in the city gates. These were the leaders of a particular city. And even Greco-Roman society had kind of a similar structure. Well, the Christians just also adopted this for their churches. Check out Titus. Oh, and notice multiple elders in one city. Notice it's the elders in Ephesus. So one city would have many elders in it, not a single elder over a city. Titus, Paul writes a letter to his other dude, Titus, who's in a very similar situation to Timothy. He's giving him similar instructions that you need to appoint elders, and he's giving very similar characteristics that we'll see in 1 Timothy 3. But he says, for this reason I left you in Crete, that you might set in order what remains and appoint elders in every city, plural elders in every city. For the overseer must be above reproach as God's steward. And so you can see again in Titus, elder and overseer are used interchangeably. And so we don't have a bishop a single bishop over multiple elders, or a single leader who's ultimately the head of all the churches in one city. No, you had a whole group, a board of elders. You hate to say leadership by committee because it's got so many bad connotations and whatnot. But, you know, it was elders that were all equally responsible for guiding and leading the church in each particular city. That's how they set it up. Why do we need multiple elders? You know, our church has 10 elders. I'm one of them. Why do we need 10 elders? I mean, why do we need, well, 10 is just kind of an arbitrary number, actually. It's not like we have a certain number that we're looking to fulfill. That number changes. We were at 11 until a couple months ago when one of our elders went to another city to try to plant a church. But why do we need multiple elders at all? Well, for one, for accountability. You know, if one elder starts going off track, there's hopefully another, there's others that are holding that person accountable. If a member in the church feels like an elder is out of line, there's other elders that they can appeal to. Like if one of you felt like I was doing something real messed up, you could come talk to me about it. If I don't agree, you could go talk to my fellow elders, and they would launch an investigation to see is there any merit to the accusations that are being leveled. And so accountability is what we need at this level of spiritual leadership. Also safety. You know, one of the problems with having a single person in charge of an entire church is if that person goes astray, if that person heads in the wrong direction, then who is there? What sort of checks and balances are in place to keep the entire church from going down? You know, if God has an enemy, the Bible calls Satan. If Satan can lead one person astray and take the whole church down, that's pretty convenient for him. And so we need multiple people, and hopefully there's safety in numbers. Additionally, we want to avoid man-centeredness. You know, a lot of big churches around the country, the whole thing is built around one single charismatic individual. And the problem is, when that person retires, if that person gets into some sort of a scandal, the rest of that church is in deep trouble. There's actually instances where churches were trying to take out loans to build a new facility because their church was growing so much. And the banks will make them take out a multi-million dollar life insurance on their senior pastor, because the bank knows if that guy goes down, we are not getting our money back. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to avoid this superstar thing. You know, I love the fact that every quarter I'm going to rotate over next door and somebody else is going to come in here. Everybody's got their own favorite teachers. You know, most churches, all of the attendance is built around the charisma and the preaching of one individual. Our church just isn't like that, and I love it. Finally, availability. You know, we've got 10 elders, so theoretically our elders should be 10 times as available as a church that only had one elder. There's just a lot of people that might need help, a lot of people that might need to talk to one of the elders, and the more we've got, the more availability that we have. And so this is the New Testament pattern. This is the way that our church is set up. We have our elders. We also have deacons, which that's just the word for servant, the Greek word for servant. And this is an office. We've got 600 or 700 deacons. We call them the servant team because the word deacon means servant, and it seems a little more descriptive of what they do. But the elders are elected by the deacons, and the deacons have to get approved by the elders to get into our servant team, I guess. And he says that whoever aspires to be an overseer desires a noble task. And so some people kind of feel like, isn't it arrogant to want to lead for God? I remember feeling that way. I remember I was actually taking a class where we were studying through the different character qualifications for elders and how churches should be governed and things like that. And I remember I was sitting at, it was over at Hound Dog's Pizza. This is a long time ago, but I was sitting there. A few of us were doing a homework together, and I was sitting there and I was just like, I want to be an elder someday. And the girl that was sitting across the table from me just looked at me with this horrified look on her face. And she was like, I think that's the most arrogant thing that I've ever heard. And I was like, oh man, yeah, that's really bad. And I felt kind of this sense of like shame. Is that just arrogant or whatever? Not according to Paul. He seems to speak pretty highly, actually, of wanting to lead for God. You know, a desire to be used by God, especially when you understand leadership. It's not like the world's view of leadership, Jesus said. He said, you know, in the world, leaders lord it over people. Leadership is an excuse to not have to do the dirty work, an excuse to take it easy, to get more money, to have people that you can tell to do things. Christian leadership, Jesus says, if you want to be great, you should be the servant of everyone. And so it's servant leadership. It's a choice to lay my life down for other people, to try to get under other people and lift them up, not to get over other people and push them down. And so properly understood, a desire to be a leader for God is an awesome, noble task. And we need as many people as possible to want that and be striving for that. You know, this usually requires a second decision. You know, there's the first decision to become a Christian. And this is a decision to receive forgiveness thanks to what Christ has done for us, to be cleansed by him, by his sacrifice, by his offering himself up on the cross. But then there usually comes a second decision later on in our spiritual lives where we begin to grow spiritually and we start to realize what God has done for me and what the implications of that are, how much I've been loved by him. And as a result, it can well up into this decision that I want to give my whole life over for his service. And so this is a decision to offer myself and my life up to him and to say, God, I want to do whatever you want me to do with my life. I want to lead for you. I want to influence other people for you. And that's often a second decision. That's a decision that maybe some of us here tonight have yet to make. Maybe some of us have made that decision. But I praise God that so many people in this church really want to be home church leaders, elders. They want to be used by God in very powerful ways. Why would anyone want to become a spiritual leader, though? I mean, why would I want to become the servant of all? Why would I want to become the least, like Jesus says? Well, I'll give you a few reasons here. For one, this is the key to a healthy Christian community. You know, some people really like their home church and stuff, and what they don't realize is that the reason why this community as a whole is here, not to mention your home church, is because other people decided to do this. Other people decided to throw in on this project of leadership. You know, this is the answer to Timothy's problems at Ephesus. You know, sometimes the church in its history has had a tendency to crack down. You know, this is why the church in the second and third centuries moved from multiple elders to a single individual in charge of the various churches spread throughout the Roman Empire. And that was the step that was the fatal move that they made that allowed heresy to come in and to take over the church and for the teaching of the church to get off track. And so part of what the church has done is, oh, there's false teaching. Let's just clamp down and not let people minister. What they should be doing is trying to raise up awesome, godly leaders. And that's what Paul tells Timothy to do. You need to get good leaders, spiritual people, milling throughout this city of Ephesus, teaching the right things, confronting the wrong things, loving people, building people up, and training up leaders of their own. So this is the key. Also, you're going to need, most of us will need to lead our families someday. You know, you want to have a healthy marriage, you want to have a healthy family, that's going to take leadership. You're going to have to lead that along. And I mean, you're going to have to stand before God someday, and he's going to be like, so how did it go with your marriage and with your family? And if you're just going to be like, I don't know, why are you asking me? That's not going to be good enough. No, there's tremendously fulfilling relationships available, but you've got to lead that. Also, you're already an influencer in some capacity, whether it's you may be influencing for bad, but if you're already an influencer in some form of the word, why not be a good one? Why not be a spiritual influencer? Paul says at the end of this section that those who have served well gain an excellent standing and great assurance in their faith in Christ Jesus. And so he gives a few more reasons. One, see that deeper faith, great assurance in their faith. There's something about stepping forward into spiritual leadership and seeing God work through me, as imperfect as I am. It's faith building. This leadership will not leave you the same person. It will change you into a person that you never imagined that you could be. You can't stay the same. It won't let you. You know, challenges are going to come your way, and God is going to grow you. He's going to deepen your faith, deepen your trust in him as you step out and take scary steps of faith. He also says an excellent standing. And so this would be praise from other spiritual people. You know, you're going to catch flack for stepping up into leadership as well from some people. because you're doing the right thing. But you'll also get praise from people, and you'll receive praise from Christ. Jesus talks about this scene at the end of our lives when we step into his presence. You know, when we receive our new bodies and we shed all of the pain and worries of this life, and we step in his presence, and he says, "Well done, good and faithful servant." That he's actually going to go through and talk about all the different things that we did for him. And he's going to praise us for that. That is awesome. There's the deep relationships that come from choosing to step forward as a leader. You look at Paul and Timothy's relationship, and you realize there's no way they would have had this if Timothy had not said, "Yeah, I'll come along and lead. I want to learn to lead, Paul, and I want to learn from you." The bond that you form, you know, I remember working at, the first job I ever worked at was Burger King, okay? And I remember just the sense of closeness that I got with, like, you know, it was like, you know, I'm running like the Whopper station, okay? And another guy's over here running the fries and the, you know, the chicken and stuff. And, you know, it's like, you know, dinner rush, and we're like, "Yeah, we're killing this thing," you know? And you just get done, you're like, "Oh, that was awesome." And you feel close. And then, you know, you got after work and there's nothing to talk about because the relationships build on, you know, trying to get your drive-through time down as low as possible. But with spiritual leadership, what you're doing is something real and significant. And the closeness that you form as you go through battles together, it's more like the kind of closeness you see war veterans talk about. You know, the love, if you've read or seen Band of Brothers, you just see the love and admiration that these guys had, especially for their leaders, but also for one another in the trenches. And there's a depth of relationships that's only possible through serving God. Also, it's because Christ said we should. He says in John 15, he says, "Look, no servant is greater than his master." John 13:15. "No servant's greater than his master. No student is greater than his teacher. Look, I've shown you what sacrificial leadership is. Now you need to do that for other people." And he says, "And if you know these things, you're going to be blessed if you do them." And so he promises blessing for those that choose sacrificial servant leadership. And he, like John says, we love because God first loved us. And so it's really a response to the love we've received from Christ. Now, Paul goes on and he says, "Now the overseer is to be ... And he goes on to list 15 qualities for elders and another dozen for deacons over the next 13 verses. And this list here, you know, one way of thinking about this, it's a screen to filter out phonies. You know, Timothy, he had to know who he could trust. And there's different criteria that different people use for leadership. Is it the best looking person? Is it the wealthiest person? Is it the person who's the best speaker? Paul says, no, it's the person that's like this that I'm about to describe. You know, character is what most of these center around. And character is something that cannot be faked. It's a fruit that's born, as Paul says in Galatians 5, a fruit that's born from a life truly lived for God. And he says, you need to look for authenticity, authentic believers who've been walking with God for enough time to start to see these fruits born in their lives. It's not something we just grit our teeth and try as hard as possible. No, it's where we pursue these traits as we pursue spiritual growth. God forms these in us. And so it's a screen to filter out phonies. Yeah, we can't just like, it's not like we have some sort of like, we can't look into people's souls and see how spiritual they are, see if they're authentic. But we can look at these observable qualities. It's also areas that will be put to the test. Yes, leadership will test you. It will try you. You will have long nights, long days. You'll be putting in the study. You'll have people that are angry about you because you're just speaking the truth of God. And a lot of leaders don't make it. You know, you think about like a bridge. And, you know, the bridge has to have its foundations in place for it to support the weight that's going to be put upon it. And the more weight that's put upon it, the stronger the foundations need to be. You know, a bridge that's got, you know, 12 out of 15 pillars are in pretty good shape. You know, that's not good enough. Because the weight will find out those weak points and can cause the whole thing to collapse. And, you know, I kind of think about it, you know, as I've stepped up into higher levels of leadership, each time I step up to the next thing, you can feel the weight, and it's almost like another 50 pounds has been put into the backpack. And, you know, before my knee was feeling pretty good, but with that extra 50 pounds, I realized, okay, I'm going to need to strengthen that part a little bit more. My wife and I recently did a lengthy hiking trip over several days. And, you know, I felt going into this like, I'm in pretty good shape. I think I'll be able to handle this. Well, I'd never put that kind of strain on my body. And so I got muscles hurting that I didn't even know existed. There's like this muscle that runs right up along the side here. I guess it's some stabilizer muscle. That thing felt like it was on fire for the first 3 or 4 days. You know, the skin between my toes, you know, it can handle normal walking around. But, you know, hiking for 8 hours, pounding away, you know, I got these massive blisters in between my toes. And, I'm going through like a whole roll of moleskin just to try to make it to the next station. Okay, but you know, what it was, you know, under the conditions I was under, my body held up just fine, but then more stress gets put on it, and all of a sudden I'm hurting. And that's what leadership can be like. And that's why Paul says, look, you don't want to just throw just anybody in there, because that's not good for them or the church. They're going to get devoured by the strain that's going to come. And so God, he'll ease you into this. He'll give you baby steps that you can take. And, you know, he doesn't just go take you to the gym and throw 500 pounds on the bar. He works you up to it, okay? But this is also a vision for spiritual maturity. You know, if this is how Timothy's to recognize spiritually mature people, then this is something that's not just for people like Timothy selecting elders, but also for people like the rest of us who want to know what spiritual maturity looks like. And so this vision, as we look through this, you know, these are qualities that nobody's going to have all of these completely. You know, this is more relative. These are relative to the rest of the group. You're looking for the most mature people to be raised up as elders. And so these are goals for us to shoot for, that we can aim for in our own lives, and we can allow God maybe to speak to a weak point in our lives that might be affecting the level of service we're trying to offer up to God. I should point out, these are pretty good things to look for in a spouse. I don't know if anybody in this room is looking to get married someday, but there's a lot of, I don't know, there's a lot of things that the world says to look for in a spouse, and most of them aren't on this list. God's got a different plan in mind for what spiritual and relational maturity looks like. And so these are some pretty good features to look for, and also, even more importantly, to seek to cultivate in yourself, because you can look all day long for somebody that's like this, but if you're not like this, then you're not doing your part in the whole thing. So the overseer is to be, we're going to just look at five of these tonight. It's to be above reproach. He says this for deacons as well in 3:10. And this is kind of a general heading. Above reproach, above accusation, not accusable or not culpable is the Greek word here. And, you know, leaders are not sinless. That's not what he's saying, that you can never be accused of any sin. Some people are pretty disappointed when they see sin in their leaders, and they get really bitter, and they're like, well, I'm not going to walk with God at all anymore and stuff. And it's like, okay, if you're holding out for perfect leaders, you're greatly mistaken. That's not what God puts forward. He puts forward messed up people. What Paul is calling on for from Timothy here is to try to find people that don't have these obvious blatant flaws in them. You know, accusations, they're going to come no matter what. I mean, Jesus got accused of all kinds of stuff. The Apostle Paul got accused of all kinds of things. And you can't avoid all accusations, but this is why you need to make sure there's nothing really serious that you can be accused of. Because the false accusations, there's going to be enough of those. And if you're giving people that want to accuse you easy targets, then that's not going to be good for leaders. You know, the church can come into disrepute as well if its leaders are looked upon as people with these glaring weaknesses. And so we can't have that. This does imply indigenous leadership as well. Meaning, instead of leadership that is imported from the outside, leadership that arises up right from within the church. You know, Jesus says in John 10 that the good shepherd, you know, one of the things he has going for him is the sheep know his voice. You know, the shepherd would just go into a pen with all kinds of shepherd sheep and would call out to the sheep, and the sheep would follow him out to pasture. And so that shepherd has spent time with those sheep and loves them and knows them. And it's more like a pet than livestock. And, you know, what a lot of churches do when they need leaders is they go to this online database and they put in their criteria, what they're looking for, the salary range, the size of the church, the location, do you accept female pastors? And then other pastors log in and it's kind of like a monster.com for churches. And they can basically, you know, these elder boards will get a list of 500 pastors that meet your criteria, and then they'll narrow them down to 20, and then they'll interview some people and bring them in for a trial sermon, and then the congregation is supposed to decide based on that. I think that is so weird. In the early church, I just can't imagine what they would think if they saw us training and choosing leaders this way. No, leaders come up from within. We don't go up to, you know, some church in Minneapolis and try to hire their pastor away. No, we raise up our own people. We're very resistant to importing other leaders. And so above reproach, that's where the whole community knows this person, trusts this person. This is where that person's influence is going to come from. It's from the long-term relationships that they've built. It's from the churches that they've planted. It's from the people who they've discipled, who they've mentored up into leadership. That's where it's going to come from. The overseer is also to be faithful to his wife, and this is, again, required of deacons. You know, the Greek is literally here a one-woman man. It's kind of a weird construction. One-woman man. It's three words that comprise this. It's probably not referring to polygamy. Some people think that, you know, well, polygamy would have been common in the ancient world. Not really. It was quite rare in the Greco-Roman world. Not something Paul would have needed to speak to. What he's probably referring to are the promiscuous sexual practices of this time. Check out what 4th century Demosthenes says about the sexual lives of the people in Athens. He says, "We keep mistresses for pleasure, concubines for our day-to-day bodily needs, but we have wives to produce legitimate children and serve as trustworthy guardians of our homes." That doesn't mention the prostitutes, which funded the state temples. So the state was pretty in favor of the prostitutes because they got tax dollars from it. It also didn't include the worship rituals, which were highly sexualized and involved sex. So, you know, the average guy, you'd have your wife to raise your kids and take care of your home. You'd have your concubine for day-to-day needs. You had your mistress. This was like, you know, the person you really bonded with and you would talk with. And this is kind of like your best friend and stuff. You'd have your prostitutes you could go and get. And you also had your worship. And what Paul says is, what the early Christians were saying is, actually, this is not the way it's going to be with God. We talked about this a few weeks ago, so I won't get into all this. But he says, from now on, your lover, the mother of your children, you know, the person who you have sex with, these are all going to be the same person. And his audience was like, "Whoa, you're blowing my mind. I never thought of that before." And that's what people really want. They want to, even today, people want to have a fulfilling, awesome marriage with somebody whom they love, with a great sex life, building a family together. This is something that surveys show people want badly. A lot of people are so cynical they've given up on that, unfortunately. But what God says is, no, I can teach you how to do this. I can grow you to the point where that is something that you can actually experience. It's not going to be easy, but I'm there with you. And a lot of people who were very cynical and hopeless and messed up in the area of their sexual lives have gained so much victory. We've got examples sitting around this room and throughout this church of people who felt cynical and hopeless about sex and marriage, and yet God has made them into a different person today. And so really what he's talking about here is sexual self-control. Very different than these false teachers. It says in 2 Timothy 3:6 that they were moving in on these women in the church, and they were preying on these women. And he says, no, the leaders in the church are not going to be this way. Sexual self-control. It's not prohibiting divorcees or singles from holding eldership either. You know, some churches take this to say, we can't have divorcees as pastors or elders, people who have been divorced. Even if it was, you know, 25, 30 years ago, back when I was a non-Christian getting divorced, And I hear the person's married and has a healthy family and stuff, but they're like, sorry, you're divorced, and it says husband of one wife, and this is your second wife. These traits refer to present characteristics. You know, when it says, you know, somebody who doesn't, like we'll see next week, doesn't have an anger problem, it doesn't mean they never had an anger problem. It means they don't now, and they've grown past that. You know, Paul was a murderer. You know, you certainly wouldn't want to see murderers among your elders. And yet, you know, that he was qualified because he wasn't murdering anymore, all right? It's also not, can't be prohibiting singles because Timothy was single. Paul was single. Paul may have been married at some point. If he was on the Sanhedrin, he certainly would have had to have been married. So we don't know if he was a widower. Maybe his wife left him when he started doing his thing with Christianity. Who knows? But it's not prohibiting divorcees or singles. You know, what this is talking about is somebody who has their sexuality under control. And for married people, this would also include you have a healthy sex life. This would prohibit things like porno, flirting. You know, some guys have a way of relating to women that's really creepy. It makes them feel creeped out. And girls, you probably know what I'm talking about here. My wife will sometimes be like, you know, I really don't like being around that dude because I feel real creeped out by him and stuff. And some girls give off a real sexual vibe and real flirty and stuff. And, you know, Paul's, you know, this would be the kind of thing that would be ruled out. You wouldn't want your elders of your church to be known as people who are a little bit creepy and flirty and over the line with people of the opposite sex. You know, any inappropriate relating to members of the opposite sex, you know, lengthy counseling sessions, that's how people get into trouble. Emotional affairs, you see this maybe a little more from women, through the texting, through the Facebook, things like that. They form these bonds with people. And, you know, these things are just not appropriate for the top levels of leadership in the Church of God. We can't have this. This is a big way that we lose Christian leaders. Of sex, affairs, you know, people, the pressure is building when it comes to Christian leadership. It's you've got your life, you've got your ministry, you're trying to serve God, and the pressure just builds and builds and builds, and it can take a toll on the marriage. And sometimes people end up looking to other places. And relationships go down a path they never intended it to go down. One step leads to the next thing, and leaders can get taken out pretty hard by affairs. Very gifted people who've done a lot for God are just ruined by an affair. And this would include poor marriage choices. You know, some people who are singles, they're so out of control sexually that they might be godly in a number of other areas, but they're so out of control that they basically just marry the first thing that comes along. Or they have wrong criteria for selecting a spouse. And as a result, they marry somebody who's not that spiritual. And they can get taken out in some cases for the rest of their lives from really serving God in any sort of a significant way because of the poor marriage choice that they made. Practical steps here. I'll give you a few. I'm trying to give you some practical steps on these. One, confess. Some of you have been hiding things. It's time to go ahead and come clean with the thing that you've been into. Whether it's the thing with your boyfriend or girlfriend, whether it's the other secret, the porno that you've been getting into a lot more than you've been letting on to. You know, you've been confessing in these vague ways like, I've been struggling a little, and really that means we've been getting naked together, which is not just struggling a little, okay? Confess. You've got to get that out into the light. It's just going to get worse. Don't do the, well, I confess to God and we promise each other we're not going to do that again. No. If you're serious about this, you've got to come clean. Okay? Tonight. You wait on this till tomorrow. You're going to talk yourself back out of it again. You may have done this before. Talked yourself in and out of this. You got to come out with it. You got to flee. This is the imperative. This is the verb that the Bible uses when it comes to sexual immorality. Fleeing, this is the kind of thing that you do, like, when I think flee, I think, like, from a burning building, okay? I think, like, from a maniac with a butcher knife. You know, if there's like a maniac with a butcher knife, you're not just like, I'll just sit right next to him, you know, I'm sure everything will be fine. Flee means run like hell. And toe dangling, you know, ask yourself, am I fleeing or not here in this situation? Take preventative measures when you're thinking clearly. Do some things that can help you when you're not. Like accountability software. On our computers and all of our mobile devices. I've talked to some people where I'm like, look, you're always getting into porn on your smartphone. Do you really need a smartphone? Is this worth destroying your spiritual life? Is this worth destroying your marriage? You know, what if we go back to the dumb phone for a little while and then get some control on this? We've got a sexual integrity class coming up here starting at the end of this month. That might be a good thing to take. That'd be a good preventative measure. Take that with some of your roommates. Get some group accountability going. And replacement. Cultivating a healthy relationship with God and healthy relationships with other people. You know, part of what you're craving here is the good feelings that should come from building healthy relationships. The good feelings that should come from a healthy relationship with God. And when I say healthy relationships, I mean primarily members of the same sex. It's easy to fool ourselves into thinking, oh, you know, I just relate better. You know, guys are just like, I just relate better to girls. Or girls like, I just relate better to guys. Well, yeah, that's because of the good feelings that you get that are related to your sexuality. Learn to serve other people of the same sex and look for a spouse that's doing the same thing with members of their same sex. And then that's the kind of thing you're going to be able to do with each other once you're married. So we're above reproach. We're practicing sexual self-control. We're also temperate, which is a weird word. It's also required of deacons. When I think temperate, I think like climate. The word is nephalion. Colin Brown says it can be used literally of abstinence from wine, so sobriety. But also can be figuratively indicating complete clarity of mind and its resulting good judgment. Yeah, and he mentions wine later. We'll talk about that next week. So it's probably talking about the figurative sense here. Clarity of mind, good judgment. I think mentally sharp is a much better term here that more captures the sense of this word. And so this is the person that's spiritually alert and engaged and on your toes. And I remember back in when I was 6 or 7 years old, I used to play Little League Baseball, and I was not very good at the time. And in fact, I was so bad that they would stick me out in right field. Because nobody at age 6 actually has the power to hit the ball into right field. And so, you know, in Little League, you're supposed to be all like, you know, down on your knees and all, hey, batter, batter, swing and stuff. And, you know, and I would just get so bored out there. I'd just be standing there, have my glove on my head. And then every once in a while, you know, this dude would come up to the plate who, you know, we're 6 years old, but the dude's got facial hair. We used to play these teams from the country where I think they had kind of funky birth record, you know, checks and balances. So, and I'd be standing there and the dude would just jack one out the left field and everybody would look to me and I'm just like, you know. I was not alert. I was not ready. And, you know, some of us, you know, this is kind of like our spiritual lives. You know, we're standing there, we got a glove on our head, we're like, we're not tuned in. You know, this person notices things and acts on those things. You know, like I know, like if we're at home church and, you know, somebody who's like really new, they like raise their hand and share for the first time. I know that pretty much everybody on my leadership team noticed that, is really excited about that. And probably several of us are looking for a chance to encourage that person after the meeting. You know, so it's this sort of alertness that we're going to have. We can't fall asleep at the wheel. You know, leaders that fall asleep at the wheel, you know, that's like the night watchman that dozes off. You can't have that. We got to be spiritually alert. We got to make the most of every opportunity. This is the kind of person that is not going to lunge around and jump to conclusions. You know, the person who doesn't have this quality, you know, the last thing that they notice, that all of a sudden trumps everything that came before that, and they're lunging around. You know, you see leaders that, you know, this year, this is the direction they're going, and next year they're going a completely opposite direction. it's not the kind of thing that inspires confidence in the people we're trying to lead. This person can take their crazy thoughts captive. And there's actually a lot of overlap between these final three traits that we're looking at here, mentally sharp and the next two. But, you know, we've got crazy thoughts that come into our brain, and we're alert enough to recognize them, to see that they're wrong, that they're crazy, and to hold them up to truth, and to say, I believe this instead, and to put those aside. This person also is able to put their problems into perspective. You know, there's some people, and I know, I used to be this way. It's like a bad thing would happen. I'd have a bad day, and I'm just like, everything is bad. My whole life is bad. I've actually seen leaders go through a rough week or two and be like, I quit. I can't lead anymore. I'm done with this. It's like a complete overreaction. It's like I've taken the last week of my life and I've projected it over the rest of my life. This is never going to end. This isn't just a hard week. You know, the person who's sharp can recognize these sorts of thoughts and is stable enough that this is not going to take them out. We can't have leaders just quitting because they've had a rough week. We can't have leaders that are just falling asleep at the wheel. A few practical steps on this one. We should try to avoid the mind-numbing escapes that so many of us are into. You know, to sit out and just to try to drink. This is part of the reason why this is tied to drunkenness. It's because that's an attempt to escape, to numb myself from life. And so one common way is through entertainment, media. We might just zone more and more out into our Facebook and our computer stuff and our games and our TV watching and movies and stuff. I'm all about getting away and getting some relaxation and rest. There are a lot better ways to do that, though, than just completely zoning out day after day after day. Study and reflection. This would imply the need for that as well. The need to study the Word to try to sharpen our mind. The need to also reflect on what's going on around me. I think the practice of daily prayer journaling, where part of that says, yesterday I dot, dot, dot. And then that's followed by, a time of prayer. I think that's a great practice, one I've been doing for many years. You catch things that you otherwise wouldn't stop and notice. And we need to pray for discernment. We need to ask God to show me what's really going on. Ask God to alert me to things that I might be overlooking here. God will answer that prayer. You're stumped about a situation, pray for discernment into it. And God might start alerting you to things. Fourth, the overseer is to be self-controlled. I'm going to go with a little different word for this one as well. A number of these actually kind of have connotations of self-control. I like stable a little bit better, sensible, sane. You know, this describes a state of relative mental health. You know, the person whose anxiety and OCD type behaviors and disorders are under control. This is the kind of person that forms and maintains friendships over a long period of time. This person can function. They know how to pay their bills. They know how to basically kind of stay on top of their lives. This person knows how to handle conflict in a mature way. More on that next week. So there's a mental health to this, the kind of person that Paul is looking for. There's an accurate evaluation of yourself. Romans 12 says, don't think of yourself more highly than you should, but think of yourself with sober judgment. Yeah, the good leader is not, talking themselves down. You know, that's bad too. But they're not trying to take on things that they can't handle. They know what are my strengths, what are my weaknesses, where do I need to get some help? There's kind of a healthy sense of boundaries here. That I know what I can do, and I know what I can't do. And I'm going to do what I can. There's also an ability to keep your head in intense situations. Like it says in 1 Peter, the end of all things is near. Yeah, Christ is coming back soon. So be alert and of sober mind so you can pray. Yes, this sobriety. This is what helps us to pray. And also the stability, the clear-headedness. You know, practical steps to stable sanity. One, admit to our problems and take responsibility to cooperate with God. Yeah, you know, we've all got a little bit of crazy in there. Okay, let's just admit to that. You know, I got all kinds of crazy behaviors. You know, I like, You know how like sometimes like out of your left eye you kind of see this side of your nose here? Like if that happens, I kind of feel like some sort of responsibility to also balance that out by looking through the other eye at that side of my nose. And so I kind of walk around kind of doing this weird thing with my head. I'll like count steps, you know? I'd be like, oh, 11 steps there, huh? Or like you're walking across a tiled floor and you're like, I've got to equally step in each square and stuff. I'm doing it up here now as I'm teaching CT. Or like you walk like in the pattern of like the knight on the chessboard, you know, it's like one over and two up or one up and two over. When I first got married, my wife would come to bed and I'd be like, you locked the door? And she's like, yeah. And I'd be like, I'm just going to go ahead and check on that anyway. And she'd be all offended. I'm like, look, if I locked the door, I would go back and check on it anyway. And she's like, that's weird. That's not good. Just because you do it to yourself doesn't mean that's normal. Okay, so it's part of it, the ability to shut my brain off at certain times when it just needs to shut up. So we need to, you know, and maybe you're just like, well, I don't have any of those problems, you know. Well, I just say congratulations, okay, because I wish we could all be more like you. We got to take responsibility. We got to know our limitations, cooperate with God in attempts to change those. That includes accepting sane advice. Some people will not even accept any input when they're in that state. That's a problem. That's a character issue. Checking for physical problems. You know, there may be. You know, I'm not necessarily opposed to medications. But you know, correcting brain chemistry, that's not sufficient in and of itself, and any doctor will tell you that as well. It's a chance to get you to the point where you can start making good decisions, but you can get back there even on your meds. So there may be some kind of physical problem there, some physiological issue. Open up about it. There's a lot of freedom that comes from just talking about it. And finally, spiritual growth goes a long way in all of these areas. But God wants to transform you by the renewing of your mind. He wants to give you a clear perspective on yourself and on life and a stability that comes with it. We got to have that from our leaders. Finally, the overseer is to be respectable. Respectable. And I'm going to go with a different word here as well. Yes, respectable, but you know, the word is cosmion. Related to the word cosmos, that's the Bible's term for this world system. It's the way that God's enemy has arranged things in this world to try to distract us from God. And so there's kind of elements of orderliness here. And so I think well-ordered might be a little bit better. You know, it's a respectability that comes from being well-ordered. You know, this is a person that has a habit of orderliness and stability established in their lives. And I hate to say it, but a lot of leaders forfeit spiritual influence because their lives are a mess. Completely scattered and disorganized. You know, they're forgetting to pay bills, defaulting on things. Slovenly appearance and body odor. You know, imagine, you know, hey, I'm a spiritual leader. Let me teach you how to become a godly man or woman. And, you know, you can smell the person from 10 feet away. You know, they haven't shaved, their clothes are all dirty and stuff. It's like, you go out in public like that? Obesity, overweight, is a disqualifying feature for spiritual leaders. The lawn, you know, this is the person whose lawn is never mowed, the house is falling apart, neglecting basic car maintenance. I had a roommate who just didn't change his oil for 2 years. And finally, the engine just stopped because there was no oil left. I was like, why didn't you change your oil? The crazy part is another one of my roommates had the same thing happen to him a month later. He watched that guy go through losing his car, and he lost his car too. You can't find anything because the car and the room are just a mess. Never knows where anything is. This is the person that never does their house job. House leaders that won't even do their house jobs. It's like, you know, it's almost a joke around the ministry house. And, you know, we wonder why we don't have any, we're losing the respect of our roommates and our disciples. And yet here we are putting our feet up and trying to make them do the dirty work. I mean, Jesus, he's the one getting down and grabbing the bucket and scrubbing away in John 13. Can't get to school or work on time. It's like, well, slept through class again anyway. I guess I got to drop out through the quarter. That just gives us more time to prepare teachings and do discipleship. It's like, you know, that, can we see how gross that is and how these two things, they just don't belong together? You know, it's like you put so much work in, to hundreds of hours into reading your Bible and getting trained and trying to minister to people, and you're forfeiting that for the couple of minutes a day it would take to get your life together. For the love of God, you're killing yourself. Paul says, look, you got to look for people that are well ordered, okay? I mean, if you think life is hard now, wait till you start trying to minister for God at high levels. It's like the whole game just speeds up. Practical steps. Get some help. Get an organized friend. Maybe there's somebody else that wants to get it together too. Try to do it with them. An exercise buddy. Some reading is really helpful. I kind of recommend for some of these things, you start with some reading before you ever try to do anything else, because part of what you got to do is you got to get convinced that this is going to be good. You got to kind of get a vision for how this is going to work. There's lots of tools out there for organizing your life. At the very least, Google Calendar. And switch to Gmail. It's going to thread all your email for you. Those 50 responses to that college ministry email, that's one line on your screen. You just delete it. There's tons of apps. There's apps for exercise and tracking your exercise. There's apps for weight loss. There's apps for, you know, I want to do this thing every day and I got a little thing I can check off and keep the chain going and stuff. There's plenty of books here on this. People have had real success in all of these areas that I've listed. It's totally possible. It might be a lot closer than you think. You'll be so much happier, okay? You got to learn to enjoy a well-ordered life. You got to realize that it's going to take more time to not do anything and just to let the chaos continue to spin out of control than it would be to move in and do something here. And there's probably a spiritual issue. I mean, there's a spiritual issue behind all these things. And, what'll happen is as you move forward in some of these areas, you'll also see yourself starting to work on the underlying issues too. So, here's the five we covered this week. Above reproach, sexually self-controlled, mentally sharp, stable, well-ordered. That's looking like a pretty good start here. You know, we see some leaders like that. That's a group that's going to get some things done. A few final thoughts then. You might be feeling kind of bad right now. I can remember coming away from studies like this and just feeling like it's hopeless. I'll never be used by God. I'll never get this area of my life together. It's been this way for so long. In some cases, as long as I can remember. And it seems to be getting worse. And so it can be kind of depressing. You need to remember that shame and self-effort are not God's way. You know, the reason why Scripture brings these up, the reason why I'm bringing these up, it's not to make people feel bad or to make people feel hopeless. You know, God is a God of grace and a God of hope and a God of change. But He cares enough not to leave you where you are. God wants to work in your life to produce these kinds of fruits. And so we need to remember that God loves you. He's committed to building this into you. Every spiritual leader started out in a disqualified state with pretty much all of these, or quite a few of them, I would be willing to bet. That's my story anyway. God loves you. He's committed to building this into you. I'd suggest you try a few of the practical steps that I suggested. I tried to give plenty there. Why don't you pick a couple? And write it down and maybe even tell somebody that you're going to try these things. And you should come back next week where we're going to tackle the rest of these. All right. So.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.